On that day, when evening had come, Jesus said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." And leaving the crowd behind, they took him with them in the boat, just as he was. Other boats were with him. A great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat, so that the boat was already being swamped. But Jesus was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. And they woke him up and said to him, "Teacher, do you not care that we are perishing?" He woke up and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." Then the wind ceased and there was a great calm. He said to them, "Why are you afraid? Have you still no faith?" And they were filled with great awe and said to one another, "Who then is this that even the wind and the sea obey him?" The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. There we go. 2 weeks ago, I preached on the practice of getting lost, thinking about getting lost as a spiritual practice, something we might actually do intentionally. And it was based on a chapter in Barbara Brown Taylor's book called An Altar in the World. In that chapter, Taylor suggests that we can learn certain skills and gain some gifts from practicing getting lost in a literal way. Those skills include managing your panic, marshaling your resources, and taking a good look around to see where you are and what this unexpected development might have to offer you. In today's reading, the disciples aren't exactly lost, though where they are and where they're going is significant, and I'll get to that later. But as they encounter stormy weather in the middle of the Sea of Galilee, they definitely need to work on managing their panic. I mean, it's actually kind of an essential skill for a whole variety of situations. Getting lost can be frightening, but generally in those situations, there's quite a bit, often more than we think, that remains within our control. A storm on open water, on the other hand, evokes these images of uncontrollable elemental danger. And there are deep mythological ties between the water and the wind and waves and the forces of chaos and destruction, especially among the ancient cultures in which Jesus and his disciples lived. Stormy weather requires a force that is far beyond human skill or strength to order, contain, or overcome it. Now, I don't know about any of you, but I've personally never experienced a storm at sea or even while sailing on a lake or a pond. I just don't have that experience to connect at a literal level with this story, but metaphorically, I expect that most of us have been there at one time or another. We have a hymn that I chose not to use today, but it sings about when the storms of life are raging. Because that experience, that sense that there are forces beyond our control that have tossed us into life-threatening turmoil, that's just about universal. And so the question that we face is not how do I avoid the storm, and nor is it how do I calm the storm when it happens, because that's just beyond our ability. But I think the question we face is how will I weather this storm? Overcome by fear or grounded in faith? For the writer of this gospel, that is the central question for the disciples, and it is a test that they fail over and over again. Now, faith is not just a matter of belief in who Jesus is, though that is related, but it's a matter of trust in God, and in Jesus as God's beloved child and anointed messenger. So today's story has multiple layers of meaning, which is one of the things I love about the Bible that makes so much of it so rich and so sacred, that there's not just one way to understand these stories or apply them to our lives. There is meaning and truth in these stories that does not depend on their historical or literal accuracy. So first of all, this is a story about who Jesus is from a theological kind of cosmic perspective. Jesus is one with authority over creation. He has power over the wind and sea, the forces of chaos at work in the world. His ability to create order out of chaos, just as God did in the beginning of creation, is a message to the hearers of the gospel about Jesus' relationship with God, what many would call his divine nature, his ability to act on behalf of God in ways that God can act but most humans can't. Jesus rebukes the wind just as he rebuked a demon earlier in Mark's gospel, suggesting that both demons and storms are life-threatening forces that are not of God. Jesus speaks peace, both to troubled waters and to troubled spirits. But the disciples don't quite get this yet. Although the New Revised Standard Version, the translation I read, says they were filled with great awe in response to Jesus stilling the waters, the scholars that I read this week suggest that the more accurate wording is they were fearful with a great fear. In other words, the disciples seem to be more afraid after Jesus calms the storm than they were when they woke him up in the middle of it. Now, this is also a story about who Jesus is for us today, from a personal and pastoral perspective. Jesus is the one who speaks peace, who asks why we are afraid, and where our faith is, and what it will take for us to finally trust. We are like the disciples, or the disciples are like us. As anxiety or fear increases, the ability to think clearly, logically, theologically, decreases. We cannot be our best selves, our most loving, faithful, God-reflecting natures when we are filled with fear. When fear rises because of some perceived threat, there is a series of chemical reactions in our body that activates the most ancient, primitive, reptilian part of our brains, the brainstem, the limbic system. It's a part that's driven by the desire for survival and instincts for fight or flight. The cortex, where we do our conscious and logical thinking, is practically shut down, at least for about the first 90 seconds of a crisis. From what I've read, if after those 90 seconds the perceived threat has gone away, the adrenaline subsides and we can function more rationally again. But if that perceived threat does not disappear, but continually, even chronically, keeps stimulating that fear reaction in us, we are at risk of getting caught in cycles of anxiety and reactivity for a long, long time. Now, I'm in a continuing education program this whole year and part of next year called the Center for Pastoral Effectiveness. And part of what we learn about is how to be a non-anxious leader, even in situations where there is a lot of fear and anxiety. And our mentor for this program, Bill Selby, who has preached here before, says that when we're in that place of doubt and fear, we tend to revert to about age 13. It's an age when we think we're independent, but we still want to blame others when things go wrong. When we're caught up in that fearfulness and uncertainty, we also tend to want others to be caught up with us, to show that same level of alarm, that sense of urgency that makes us feel so out of control. And we see this in the disciples here. Like a teenager faced with a calm, authoritative, boundary-setting parent, we too can go from an internal reaction of, I'm scared or I'm angry, to, you don't even care about me. And so the disciples say, Teacher, don't you even care that we're about to die? But as I read through the story again and again this week, a new question occurred to me. What were the disciples supposed to do? I mean, I get that Jesus isn't real pleased with how they react, that they're not responding to the situation in the way that he would hope for them. But does that mean they shouldn't have woken him up? I mean, the boat was being swamped. Their lives were in danger. They had good reason to be afraid. And they actually got something right in believing that Jesus had some power to help change the situation for the better. So I don't think it's that they weren't supposed to wake him up. I don't think Jesus was mad because they interrupted his nap or upset that they couldn't handle the storm on their own. I think the lack of faith he chides them for is shown in that first question. Do you not care that we are perishing? They are overcome by fear because they do not yet understand or trust who Jesus is. That he is a person so rooted in an awareness of God's love, not only for himself, but for everyone else as well. That he is the clearest image we have of what God's love looks like in human form. The thing is that faith or peace, which is the fruit of faith, doesn't mean that we never feel afraid. Instead, I think it means that we find a way to let that fearful emotion, with all of its physiological reactions and instincts, wash over us without sweeping us away. The life of faith offers so many resources for overcoming fear and finding peace, for connecting with the one whom we can trust because God's love is unbounded. This faith, this peace, is not necessarily a once and forever kind of gift that once you've got it, you're good. It's a process, as I'm sure you all have figured out. But the life of faith gives us this toolbox that we can draw tools from, skills for seeking that which centers and grounds us even in the midst of the storm. Whether it's deep breathing or prayer, meditation or mindful walking, there are many spiritual practices that can help us wait out that rush of adrenaline and find our way back to reason and compassion, to faith and love, instead of fear and self-preservation. To me, this is the beauty of the quotation I chose for today's thought for meditation from Saint Seraphim. Acquire inner peace, and thousands around you will be saved. When we are not swept up in the storm, we hold on to the capacity to be our best selves, to speak peace in the midst of turmoil, to lead others toward our shared vision and our highest values. After all, the one we follow, Jesus, called the Christ, was linked with the words of Isaiah that describes the Messiah as Prince of Peace. He speaks words of peace because he himself is at peace. He is filled with God's peace, which in the Gospel of John says is not like the peace that the world gives. In both the Gospels of Luke and John, Jesus speaks and offers peace to the disciples many times, especially as he draws near to his death, and again when he appears to the disciples after the resurrection. The peace that Jesus knew and offers to us is not based on pretending that there is nothing to be afraid of. The dangers, the threats, the chaos, the disorder of the storm, they are real. And we are justified in feeling fear. But the peace that Jesus offers is a matter of knowing and remembering, even in the midst of the storm, that we are not alone, that we are not forgotten, but that God cares deeply about us and is with us. And so inner peace is a gift of grace that is born from and sustained by faith. So when Jesus asks his followers, "Have you still no faith?" I think it's less about their surprise that he had the power to calm the storm, and more about whether or not they trust him and his God to care about them in their distress. There will be storms and stormy weather, especially if we set out to follow Jesus. It's no coincidence that this storm comes up as Jesus and his followers are crossing to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. They are going from Jewish territory to Gentile lands. They are pushing the mission of the reign of God beyond the borders that they, other than Jesus, had expected it to stay within. The journey of faith tends to do that, to lead us out of our comfort zone toward unfamiliar territory and people we don't know and may not even like. We may get lost on the way. Storms may come up that we cannot control. It's okay to feel afraid, or whatever more subtle word we choose, nervous, concerned, apprehensive, anxious, uncertain, worried, hesitant, uneasy. But if we seek to be people of faith, God invites us to let faith and not fear have the final word in how we weather life's storms. Even when it seems like Christ is sleeping, with no care for the danger that we're in, we are all in the same boat, and we are not alone. Thanks be to God. Amen.